Hi, I'm Keith.
Hi, I'm Ragini.
And welcome to More Than Masala, a podcast where a chef and a culinary researcher talk about spices from the Indian subcontinent, from how to use them to sometimes the dark history behind their origins. Every episode, Ragini and I do a deep dive into one spice and talk about the history as well as how to use the spice. Welcome back to the More Than Masala podcast, and I am so excited to be here finally releasing our first episode of 2022 after a nice little break. And I don't know about you, Ragini, but I always, in the beginning of the new year, I'm always like, 2021, oh yeah, that's right, it's a new year. But we are in 2022, and it's so good to be back with you. How are you?
I'm good, Keith. Thanks. Yeah, for sure. Every time someone says Happy New Year, I'm still thinking last year was 2020. And then I have to catch myself and be like, no, we're in 2022 now. But yeah, no, for sure. And we're also coming up to our second year of More Than Masala.
That's crazy. It happened so quick. And I'm excited to share with everyone how awesome second year is going to be, because we're recording so, so many more. This podcast is just going to grow. And it's thanks to all of our listeners. We've gotten so many cool responses and feedback. I'm always super humbled.
Yeah, for sure. I think my favorite part of every conversation that we have on the podcast is kind of what comes out after it, which is people engaging with us, like teaching us new things every single time we see either a new usage of the spice, or we learn something from a different culture sparked by something that was, you know, came out of the podcast. And so I think my favorite thing is how much we get to learn after the episodes come out.
Yeah, I think you said it perfectly. So thank you. If you're listening to this and you're sharing this, whether it's on Instagram or Facebook or TikTok or YouTube or Twitter, I think I got the main ones there.
Thanks, guys. We really appreciate it.
Without further ado, let's launch into today's topic, which is going to be pepper. And oh, I can't wait, because I know that you've got some awesome stories and some facts with us. So take it away.
Local natives were particularly curious to know why the English required such huge quantities of pepper, and there was much scratching of heads until it was finally agreed that English houses were so cold that the walls were plastered with crushed pepper in order to produce heat. Giles Milton, Nathaniel's Nutmeg, How One Man's Courage Changed the Course of History. So from that quote, hopefully what you've gleaned is that not only was pepper extraordinarily popular with the English, but it was so popular that even those who were supplying it at some points wondered exactly what they were holding on to. I mean, pepper was known as black gold, and it's no surprise, or I suppose it's no, you know, sort of there's nothing really for us to wonder about, because even today, the amount of pepper that's traded in the world is almost equivalent to the sum total of the trading of every other spice. So, I mean, we really love pepper as a global community. Like, I think, you know, salt and pepper, pepper shakers, pepper's pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. And you can think of so many recipes and so many uses. It's crazy to think how pepper has just really changed the entire course of history.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think every single time we talk, I say the line, spices are the quiet heroes of history. And if that's true, then pepper is the king of these quiet heroes. I mean, it's called the king of spices, but it's definitely the king hero of history as well. And I just want to clarify that there are two kinds of pepper. There's obviously the round peppercorns, which are the more common ones. And then there's the long pepper, which is largely medicinal. And so we're not really talking too much about that today. Today, we're going to focus on the round pepper berries. Basically, I'm going to take you to, I want you to close your eyes and cast your mind to the Spice Coast, which is 300 miles of beautiful shoreline in Kerala, hot weather, blue skies, aggressive monsoon, and lots of pepper.
So let's go to, I'm so ready. Let's go to God's country and tell us where it all started.
All right. So like I said, pepper was black gold. And this black gold is from the Malabar coast of Kerala. This is where it originates. And, you know, unlike many of the spices that we cover in that we've covered on this podcast, pepper is kind of an interesting one for the reason that it actually does originate on the subcontinent, and very specifically on the Malabar coast. but it's not the most popular spice on the subcontinent. And so today what we're going to do is we'll just have a little walk through history, because pepper definitely has a very interesting history. And it's much more popular in South India than it is in North India, but there are some very characteristic uses of it across the subcontinent nonetheless. And so people can't necessarily do without it, but it's in terms of quantity, it's not one of the most used spices. So where should we start? I think a good place to start when we're talking about the history of pepper is with the Romans. Once the Romans discovered pepper, so the Greeks were in it a little bit before the Romans, but not quite at the level that the Romans were involved in pepper. And once they discovered it, the Romans honestly just couldn't get enough pepper. You know, they were importing tons and tons of pepper every single time. And they were doing it largely because they owned Egypt at the time. Egypt was sort of a part of the Roman Empire, and they were buying it from the nomadic Arab traders. So the Arab traders would sail from strategic ports to India for pepper. And eventually, once Egypt was annexed by the Romans, who then took control of the trade, they would buy it from the Arabs. And Egypt was that kind of, or Alexandria specifically, was that kind of strategic port that pepper was brought to. And the Romans would, you know, buy it all up. But what they didn't have control of is sourcing the pepper. And this would last for a very long time, that the Arab traders would keep their secret from, you know, all the way from 408 to 410 AD to the 15th century. And Europeans just had no idea how and where pepper was produced. Eventually, Rome would fall. And interestingly, when Rome was attacked by the barbarians in 408 BCE, what they wanted was gold, silver, and you guessed it, pepper. And, you know, Rome falls at this point, and over time, the knowledge slips out of mind for Europeans. And the Arab traders come back in with a vengeance, and everything that Rome had sort of taken in terms of buying large quantities and selling on to Europe, they started up this trade themselves again, where they were not only sourcing it from the Malabar coast, but they were also selling it onto all of their European partners. And once Rome fell, the Arab traders had, like I said, a hold on the trade for pepper well until the 15th century. And they had all kinds of really interesting stories about, you know, how pepper was produced. And there was a real mystery around, you know, why it was that very, very skilled folks who knew where it grew were the only people who could access it. And now, I don't know if this is, you know, urban myth or legend or what have you, but one of the stories that was making its way around is that, you know, what would happen is that serpents lived around the pepper forests. And so they were deadly serpents, and there was no way that human beings could go in and pick these berries off the vine. And so what they would do is they would light fire to the forest. And this is what turned the peppercorns black. And then as soon as the fire was out, very skilled pepper pickers had to run in and pick the pepper off the vine before the snakes made their way back in. Now, I mean, this sounds like a bit of a tall tale to me, but who knows? Maybe there's some truth to it, but there's some much easier and less life-threatening ways to get pepper off the vine as well.
That's amazing. With all these incredible stories and talking about its value, there has to be some wild stories around pepper, specifically when it comes to value and things of that nature, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the sort of the crazy stories that the Arabs kind of spun around the spice trade were really interesting. And the next time, our next spice that we're going to talk about, which I'm not going to give away, that one has what I think is the most interesting story. But I think the story with the serpents is one that kind of makes me laugh, like thinking about, you know, like a European tradesman on the ports thinking about, you know, where this pepper is coming from and holding this black gold in his hand and all the rest of it. But interestingly enough, anybody who worked with pepper for a long, long time in history, whether they were part of the trades process, whether they were part of the purchasing process in the ports, whether they were part of the processing of pepper, they weren't allowed to wear cuff trousers so that no peppercorns got stuck in their cuffs because it was it was in fact that valuable. So even in terms of like the outfits that people wore, you know, that's kind of how it happened. But I'm going to come to another story with just a little bit of history before that. So in the 15th century, pepper was believed to be a cure for the plague, for the Black Death, and the Arabs still had control of the trade as well as the vast income, but this was soon going to change. And essentially, everyone's favorite Portuguese man, Vasco da Gama, who was the son of a nobleman, he went out, his mission when he left, when he set sail, was to find pepper. And so he goes around the Cape of Good Hope, he goes into the Indian Ocean, and in May 1948, you know, finds himself on the Malabar coast. And it was also the first European ship to find the sea route to India, which then, you know, as we know, changes the course both of the spice trade and history. So once again, just reiterating this point that a lot of the age of European colonialism was driven by the search for spices. And next time we're going to talk a little bit about our friend Christopher Columbus when it comes to this as well, but almost all of the very notable explorers that we know of today set out with the intention to find spices because they were in fact so, so valuable. And so da Gama opens up the sea routes. And today, just as it is today, it was then, it was all about supply and demand. And so in the 16th century onwards, the Portuguese are at the forefront. Western appetites for spices are high, and essentially what they couldn't obtain by trade, they would obtain by forced. And so first they took the pepper trade, then they set forth for another taste, another spice that they were prepared to pay exorbitant prices for, but you'll have to wait until next time to find out which one that is. Anyway, when they got to the Malabar coast, what they didn't expect to find was a cosmopolitan city. So the city of Cochin, they didn't expect it to be anything more than a collection of savages, which of course it was. You know, Muslim traders, Jewish traders, Arab traders, Chinese traders had been trading from this port for centuries prior to the Europeans having found it. And so pepper was to Cochin at that time, you know, sort of what oil is to the Gulf today, you know. And so this is kind of the crazy story. The trading, the way that pepper was traded and the way that a price was agreed is still something that is done today in very much the same way. And so you have these large hauls, and the deals are largely conducted not only in silence, but also in secrecy. So there's a language that all of the traders know. And that language is, depending on how many fingers I press, that's the price we are agreeing per kilogram. And so what they do is the buyer and the seller will sit across from each other, and they're in rows and rows and rows in these large halls. The buyer and the seller will sit across from each other. They'll throw a towel over their hands, and the deal will be conducted in silence under the towel so that no one else gets a whiff of what kind of deal that particular buyer is getting or how much profit this particular seller might be making. And so that I think is something that's super unique, is that that's continued till today. And really, you can walk in today and what you would see is very much what would have happened in the, you know, 16th, 15th, 14th centuries.
That is so cool. It's like, if it's not broke, don't fix it. And this has been working clearly. That, oh man. This is what I love about what we do, like these cool little nerdy facts where we get to kind of talk about that. But let's talk about, like, how does it grow at this point? So do we have pepper plantations?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely do. And actually, just one thing to add in terms of how much money people were making over pepper. So Vasco da Gama's first voyage to India, which obviously would have been the most expensive because, you know, there's no setup there. It's like going somewhere for the first time, your navigation costs are really high, your time taken to get there is probably longer than it will be, you know, in times to come. And with his first sort of, with his first return and all the spoils of his return, which was 1,500 tons of pepper, plus another 30 tons of other spices, it paid for his, not only his expedition, but it paid for his expedition and his army seven times over. That is one journey, the first of the journey. So it's Wow. It's no shock then to know or to understand that Lisbon became one of the wealthiest cities in Europe. It's because the Portuguese were trading at this level and becoming the suppliers, and you know, they slowly started to replace the Arab traders, and then eventually the Spanish came in and the Dutch and eventually the English. So we see this kind of slow displacement for something that the Arab traders have controlled for centuries, one after the other. Now the Europeans are going to come in fairly quick succession. But okay, let's get to harvesting. So yes, pepper is, it's a creeper plant and it's typically attached to the coral tree. And it also grows around coffee a lot, and it sort of grows in clusters of berries. So it's sort of like a micro bunch of grapes is how pepper is picked. And so black, white, and green pepper all come from the same plant. So it, when it ripens, it's in its green form. And essentially, in order to make white pepper, what's done is that green pepper is boiled and the green skin comes off, and what you're left with is the white pepper inside. And now white pepper, if you've tried it, it's got a peppery flavor, but it's not as pungent as black pepper. It's not as smoky as black pepper. It doesn't get the back of your throat the way that black pepper does. In order to make black pepper, those green berries, pardon me, are dried either through sunshine or by heat, and they eventually shrivel up and sort of become black. And what's interesting is that pepper, much like wine, is traditionally harvested with using feet rather than hands. And so once you pick all of these bunches of pepper berries off the tree, the skill is in being able to quickly dislodge them with your feet in this sort of dance, not squashing the pepper berries, getting them all off so that you have individual berries. Because if you think about how we buy it in the supermarket, we definitely buy individual peppercorns. We don't buy, we don't buy bunches of peppercorns, as it were. And it's still harvested by hand thousands of years later. You know, if you look at the ladders that people use to harvest pepper, they're these somewhat, they're stable, obviously, but you really need to know how to like balance your body weight, because they're very thin, long bamboo ladders. It's essentially a bamboo pole with, if you think of a traditional ladder, it's, two poles with the step in between, whereas this is the pole in between with the steps coming out on either side. So your balance has to be incredible to hold yourself going all the way up, pick the pepper and come down without toppling over, which I don't highly doubt. I could not do. So mad respect.
I just like that there's now a pepper dance. Like, come on, TikTok. Like, why don't we get on that?
Right.
Right. That's so cool. Now let's talk about the difference between green and white, red and black. And, obviously the pepper shakers that you see with these tricolors and blends like that, how did that kind of get started? And what do you think some of the differentials between those varieties are?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let's just break down the differences between the varieties real quick. So green pepper is the ripe berry on the plant. Now, not used widely in the subcontinent. In Kerala specifically, what we have to remember is that communities that rely on a crop, whatever that crop is, will typically have some sort of ritual around the crop. And they'll also have integrated the crop into their diet far more than anyone else. So for me to say we don't really use green peppercorns across the subcontinent is accurate, but in Kerala, they pickle green peppercorns, especially around where these peppercorns grow, and they also cook these green peppercorns. However, we see most notable use of the green peppercorn in Southeast Asian food, specifically in Thailand and in Laos. And that's where we see the green peppercorn. That's where we see the green peppercorn used the most. The white pepper, which is, boil the green and remove and you're left with the white. Again, we see most used in the East in terms of quantity. So if you think about Chinese food, it's very, very prevalent in Chinese food, way more than black peppers, for example. If we think about black pepper is your traditional, smoky, pungent black pepper. And pepper is a very important spice in Ayurveda. And so I mentioned up front that long pepper is largely medicinal, but even the round black pepper berries are very, very vital for, especially for respiratory diseases. They're very useful then, and anything to do with the throat as well. So very, very heavily used there, as well as in food South Asia. In South Asia, however, it's used as a spice, whereas arguably in Western Europe, which is the part of the world that we're kind of talking about more so, it's used more as a condiment than it is a flavoring, except for, you think maybe of like a pepper sauce to go with a steak. Other than that, it's mostly salt and pepper at the table in terms of how much of it is being used. What's interesting is that pepper used to be Actually, hold on, before I get to that, the final kind of pepper that you probably have seen in some of these fancy shakers is the pink peppercorn. Now, there is a process by which the green peppercorn can be essentially stunned and through a chemical reaction turns pink. But that's not what we're getting when we're buying pink peppercorns. When we're buying pink peppercorns, it's almost like a tongue twister. Peppy bought a pink peppercorn or something that we can write something along those lines. Anyway, when you're buying those pink peppercorns, what you're actually buying is a nut, sort of a nut from the cashew family that grows in South America. And so it's not actually pepper at all. It just happens to have a peppery taste. But it's not the same plant. It's not the same family. It is a totally different plant. It just, you know, happens to have a similar taste. So that's I suppose useful to know that pink peppercorns are in fact not peppercorns at all.
I think a lot of people just learned something here. And if you just learned something, you better share this podcast. That's the way it works, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So that's like the world history view, which is incredible, but I can imagine, and I know some of them, the uses of this spice and the subcontinent, both traditionally and kind of more progressively. Let's talk about its use in the subcontinent.
Yeah, for sure. So like I said, pepper is used in most parts of the subcontinent, but it definitely features most obviously and prominently, in the literature coming out of the south of the subcontinent. So we see Greek writings on pepper as early as 50 BCE, and Tamil literature of this early Christian period has plenty of references to pepper, the berry of Chera country, which today is Kerala. And so again, we must remember that the current state borders that we see within the subcontinent are reasonably new. And so pepper, therefore, is a much greater part of the cuisines around Kerala as much as it is. But it features heavily in Kerala, but it also features, say, in Tamil Nadu and Karnataka and so on. So if you think of like pepper rasam, for example, that's something that's, or you think of the Mulligatawny soup that the British would go on to quote unquote invent, came from, you know, pepper rasam and the word for it and so on. So there is a long, long history of pepper. And one of the reasons that the Europeans would love pepper when they discovered it is that there were many reasons they loved it, but one of it is because pepper is particularly good with meat. And now for our enthusiasts who love to berate the word curry or love to defend the word curry, depending on what side of the argument you sit on, or the debate, I should say, the word, according to Katie Achaya, the word for pepper dressed meat is curry in Tamil. So often when you look up the term curry or the origin of the term curry, it'll say spiced or spicy. But according to Katie Achaya, it's more specific than that. It's actually meat dressed in pepper is curry, which if you think about the diet of the Western Europeans, there is some logic to them picking up the term for pretty much exactly what they use pepper for. You know, they would hunt and they would use pepper to then preserve the meat that they were hunting. And that's exactly what was happening here. So I can definitely imagine a link there, whether that is the, you know, definite link. I don't think any of us can necessarily comment, but essentially meat marinated in pepper and mustard specifically would be fried. And that then was then boiled with spices like pepper and again, and tamarind and so on. And so all of those words in Tamil, which I'm not going to attempt, they end in curry. Maybe I can throw that into the ring with the curry debates.
Oh, the curry debates just keep getting deeper and deeper. But I want to address what I think is the elephant in the room, and that's salt and pepper. Like, how did we get to where we are today with it being so ubiquitous of being, you know, that salt and pepper shaker and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So interestingly, if you think about medieval Europe, I talked about how the Romans loved pepper. So if you think about from the Romans through to the medieval period, all spices were highly prized, partly because they were so difficult to get a hold of because the Arabs had a hold on the trade. And, you know, that was the route through which Europe was receiving pepper. And so the aristocrats would spice their meals very heavily. And so if you look at some of the recipes there, it looks almost like what today we might consider to be either Middle Eastern or South Asian food, because they used pepper super, super heavily. But then come about the 17th century and we start to see the definition of French haute cuisine. And as French haute cuisine is developed further and further, one of the guiding philosophies of French haute cuisine is that less is more. And because pepper was now, or spices, pardon me, were now becoming more commonplace, given that the Europeans were so involved in the trade, now that they were becoming more commonplace, they started to feature less and less in aristocrats' meals. And they started to create a different aura around spices. And so today, when we think about spiced food, we don't immediately think of Western Europe, but were we speaking in medieval times, that may not have been the case. And now, so according to Ken Albla, who's an incredible food historian, and I highly recommend everybody looking his stuff up, essentially what French haute cuisine did was it relegated most spices to dessert. So we talked, we talked at the end of last year about nutmeg. You think about pepper, you think about nutmeg, you think about cinnamon, all of these spices were sort of relegated to dessert, but pepper didn't really fit with desserts, right? And so where they weren't using a ton of, say, turmeric, it just fell out of favor. Almost no turmeric at all was used in the spicing. And then a lot of the aromatic spices, cloves, nutmeg, cinnamon, and so on, were relegated to dessert, but they couldn't quite do that with pepper. And salt was, common already because it flavored food. And salt shakers probably became popular in the late 19th, early 20th century, because essentially what a salt shaker did was it solved the issue of salt clumping on the table. And so pepper was kind of added to that, almost as an afterthought, really. And now we think of them as, best friends, but it's because people loved pepper. So there was an economic value to continuing to sell the amounts of pepper that they sold. But at the same time, the trend of the cuisine was changing. And so now pepper could be on your table and you could add it to taste, as opposed to it being something that is actually used to cook the meal.
That's so crazy. And it's funny when you think about it in the context of how valuable pepper was, and now it's this thing that's just on people's tables, like, almost as this display of wealth is kind of what I see every time I look at pepper now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think about, like, when you go to a cafeteria, especially in, I can speak for North America, but especially in North America, and you have those little white sachets, say you buy like a tub of soup or something, you have those little white sachets of salt and pepper, and the pepper in that is almost devoid of any flavor whatsoever. Like, there's no freshness to it at all. And you know that it's been processed beyond comprehension. And it's just, it's almost more for the appearance of pepper than it is for the flavor of pepper. And that goes almost a step further to when you're actually in a place that grows pepper, and it's no longer just the subcontinent, but when you're in a place that grows pepper and it's used, it's so much more than even those of us who look to buy good spices in anywhere else in the world. It's so much more even than that. And so I think one of the things that definitely happens is we don't realize how much of the flavor and perhaps even the medicinal benefits, how much of it we're losing by transporting these spices great distances, but we're so accustomed to that's what we know to be pepper.
That's just so crazy, which is another reason why I always buy really high quality spices. That should be a podcast in its own, or an episode in its own.
Absolutely.
But as we're talking about this, I kind of got the thought of, if it fell out of favor so much in the West, why is it so still heavily traded today?
So, I mean, it's still one of the most popular spices. So it fell out of favor in that it wasn't part of haute cuisine any longer. But at the same time, people were really accustomed to pepper. Governments were making a lot of money on pepper. Those who grow pepper were pushing their supply because that's what they live off of. And we haven't really yet in this podcast touched on the caste system. And I'm not not necessarily going to comment on the system here because it's not, overall, it's not a system that should be propagated in any way, shape, or form. And Keith and I have both addressed this in different ways on our Instagram pages. You're welcome to go and read all of that. But one of the features of the caste system, which is both creates expertise as much as it does binds people to a certain future, one of it is that certain castes have typically had control of the farming of certain spices on the subcontinent. And so for pepper, it's the Mandan tribe that have been cultivating pepper for centuries, and their livelihoods, you know, tribe-wide, their livelihoods depend on it. And there's so much skill in harvesting a spice that knowledge needs to be really, really carefully recorded if it's going to be democratized, right? And so there are some concerns around that. But part of the reason they've sustained it for so long is that pepper is popular in almost every corner of the world, right? Like everywhere uses pepper. And where in South Asia, you know, pepper has been a feature on the subcontinent for a long time. And so when chili made its way over, and our chili episode will be out soon, so you should watch out for that in a few months. But when chili made its way over, because it was similar to pepper, even though it's a different plant, all of the words for chili essentially come from the root word of pepper. And then if you go to Mexico, it's the other way around, where it's pimento, which is traditionally a red pepper. And then this is the black version of that. So, you know, it's contextualized to where you are, but pretty much every region in the world uses pepper. So demand never really, really fell. But over time, many other countries have started growing it, and the top importers still remain or today are the US, China, Thailand, Germany, and Spain. And the top exporters are India, Vietnam, China, and Brazil. What's interesting is that China is both one of the largest importers and exporters. I'm not entirely sure how that works, but hey, people are eating a lot of pepper.
That's fascinating. And I guarantee that everyone listening to this learned something today. So thank you, as usual, for your incredible research and for sharing your knowledge with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one last thing that I want to share with you guys. And here's sort of a challenge. And if you try this, then please, you know, show Keith and I on Facebook or on Instagram or wherever it is that you want to share it with us. You can email it into either of us if that's your vibe. But here's a recipe from King Someshwara's Manna Salasa, which is one of the few ancient texts available to us as far as food goes in India. So here's a recipe from that. I obviously don't have exact quantities, but I'll leave that to you. So soak some mung dal, and then fry together the dal, lotus root, chironji or charoli seed, ginger, and hing or asafoetida. Once it's fried, grind this and use it as a gravy base for either eggplant, jackfruit, or mutton. Garnish the dish with lots of black pepper and ginger powder. That's the recipe. So I'm going to try it out. Keith, what about you?
Yeah, you know, I'm in for this.
Cool. So watch out for it on both of our pages. And if you do try it out, then please, you know, show us, tag us, show us, send it to us. However, I'm really curious to see how this is going to taste.
Oh, I'm so excited for that. And as always, thank you guys so much for supporting what we do here. We are just spice nerds, which always would have been a good name for this podcast, but I digress. Make sure you share this, rated 5 stars, and make sure you go follow Ragini for all of this stuff, because everyone associates me with being a chef, and that's cool, but like, Ragini, you're killing it in the food scene on Instagram right now, so I'm so proud of you.
Oh, that's very kind, and right back at you. If you guys haven't yet taken a look at Keith's YouTube channel, I would highly recommend you do that. It's his super cool new endeavor, and he looks at the way we look at the history of spices on this podcast. He takes sort of popular foods and does the same thing, and like I said to you, they're very well edited videos, so kudos.
There might be a really special guest in the chai one that we just released on YouTube.
You guys love to check it out.
Well, thank you guys so much, and we'll be back very shortly with another episode. So in the meantime, have some fun, keep learning, and we'll talk to you soon.
See ya.